Welcome to the Fretboard Journal Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlini, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal Magazine. Our 52nd issue of the Fretboard Journal is mailing later this week. So if you are a subscriber, you're going to see in the next couple of weeks. Don't yell at me yet. The postal service can take a while. If you are not a subscriber yet, you're going to want to hurry up. Go to fretboardjournal.com. Click on the subscribe tab. Our issues sell out. It's just the way this magazine works. We only print enough for our subscribers and then a few extras. And we'd love to have you aboard. There's all sorts of subscriber perks that are going to be happening later this year. You've got to join us, though. fretboardjournal.com. So last week on the show, I talked to a new Fretboard Journal contributor, Cameron Noller, about his incredible book, Guitars Have Feelings Too. And today I'm keeping it in the publishing vein. I got a package in the mail about a month ago with this incredible multi-volume set of zines. Do you remember zines? For you youngsters out there, this is what we had before the internet. We had people printing things off at Kinko's or their local copy shop, or better yet, at their day job when no one was paying attention, creating small batch publishing that covered a wide range of topics, and you could do anything. This is how the Fretboard Journal started 25 years ago. I was a zine publisher. It got me hooked on sharing stories, sharing viewpoints that you weren't going to find in other more mainstream magazines, and that spirit lives on in the Fretboard Journal. So I get this package from guitarist Matt Baldwin, who's based in Southern California. The zines are called How to Play Guitar. These zines are, I don't know, 16 pages each, a piece of paper folded in half, stapled, and they're filled with little tiny insights, kernels of wisdom. It's almost like page after page of guitarist-related fortune cookie sayings, some life hacks, some quotes from famous artists, some things that Matt has learned from years of playing. I love that somebody was trying to create a zine for guitarists. I love some of the insights that I read. And then I dig a little deeper. Matt is an incredibly accomplished guitarist. He plays incredibly complex and beautiful music, sort of in the vein of Peter Lang and Robbie Basho and all those great Tacoma fingerstyle records. And then I dig even deeper still and learn that Matt is a licensed marriage and family therapist, and that he's working with clients right now, not only using music as a means to assist with therapy, but using ketamine as a means to assist with therapy. I wanted to learn all about this. I wanted to learn who this person was who's still making zines in 2023. Amazing. I wanted to learn about the ketamine-assisted therapy, which I find fascinating. And I wanted to learn about Matt's guitar work in and of itself. So that is the conversation you're going to hear. This might be controversial if it doesn't sound up your alley. You don't need to listen to it. But the beauty of zines and the beauty of the Fretboard Journal and the beauty of our podcast is that we're able to share all sorts of different viewpoints, turn you on to cool stuff happening that flies under the radar of most magazines, most outlets. That is what we're here for. I think that's why most of you tune in. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Matt. I learned a ton. I will include links to all of his contact information about the Music-Centered Psychedelic Integration and Ketamine Providers Network and all the other good stuff in the show notes. Before we get to my conversation with Matt, Deering Banjos is sponsoring the podcast once again. If you are going on any road trips, if you are camping, if you are going to any music festivals, banjos are fun. And that Deering Good Time banjo is pretty much the ultimate starter banjo. And it's more than a starter banjo. I've seen many professional musicians up on stage with their Deering Good Time. So go to DeeringBanjos.com, read up on all of their offerings. If you need instruction for your banjo playing, our friends at Peghead Nation have one of the great music instruction portals around, and you can get your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription with the promo code Fretboard when you check out. If you are listening to this podcast, you want to open up new horizons in your playing. That is why you're tuning in to this quirky show. You want to be inspired, and that's what Peghead Nation is all about. We're also brought to you by our friends at Stringjoy Strings. They don't make banjo strings, but if you need guitar strings, acoustic or electric, stringjoy.com is where you want to go. And if you use the promo code Fretboard when you check out, you will get 10% off of your first order at Stringjoy. I love String Joy. They do custom string gauges. You can send them any weird request and they probably can do it. And they can even sell you strings in bulk. It's a great company. And last but definitely not least, our friends at iZotope are offering all of our Fretboard Journal podcast listeners 10% off. Use the discount code FRET10 when you check out. I don't have any other news. I want to keep this as short as possible, but our Fretboard Summit is taking place August 24th to 26th. If you haven't checked out the lineup yet, go to fretboardsummit.org. It's going to be a great place to connect with like-minded players, our contributors, some of the brands that we feature, and myself. It's mainly just a great, fun weekend. So I hope to see some of you there. Again, fretboardsummit.org. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Matt Baldwin, the publisher of the How to Play Guitar zine series, but also a person up to so much more. I found this really insightful. I hope you do as well. Matt Baldwin, thank you for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
It's my pleasure.
So I don't know whether it was a month or two ago, the dates, they kind of blur together, but I got this package in the mail from you with your How to Play Guitar, I guess we'll call it a zine, which I haven't used that word in 20 plus years, but it is truly a zine. And I get a lot of mail, a lot of CDs, a lot of polished, you know, whatever books. And yours stood out because it reminded me of the heyday of the old punk rock zines that I grew up on. And it was filled with all these little insights. And here we are.
Yes, right. Here we are. You know, it's weird. So I've been making obscure guitar records for 20 years now. And those have sold in the way that you'd expect obscure guitar records to sell. And I was living in San Francisco maybe about 7 years ago, and I ordered some books from the legendary punk publisher V. Vale. He's the guy who did Search and Destroy back in the day. Now he does Research Publications. And he sent me an email saying, Matt, I just live a few blocks away from you. Come over and pick this stuff up. We both lived in North Beach. So I come over to pick it up, and he asked me to sit down at his table in his workshop / living room. And he makes me a cup of tea, and we end up sitting and talking for several hours, mostly about books. It turned out that we were both really into Nassim Taleb, who's this, he's like a specialist in probability and making decisions with incomplete information, you know, what he calls opaque conditions. And it also turned out that we both liked Nietzsche and other philosophers, William Burroughs, J.G. Ballard, stuff like that. And then we talked a bunch about music, including the music that I create. And at one point he said, Matt, you should make a zine. You know, you're putting out this music. There are a lot of ideas behind it. And I remember it stuck in my head. He said, it's how you're going to create hardcore fans. And that really stuck with me. And it's really proven to be true. So I'm a Gen X millennial cusper, and I've got a lot of Gen X in me in the sense that I wanted for a long time to, you know, be cryptic with my art and have people buy my records and then intuit all the layers of what was going on underneath them. And what Vale was pointing out to me was that there was a lack of generosity in that. Like an abstract expressionist painting, for instance, it might be easier to apprehend what's going on with it if there's the little white square of information next to it that you can read. So I think that that's what the zines have functioned as. And they've really been successful in a totally underground word of mouth kind of way that's led to another wave of interest in the music that I make. And it's all just printed off of a printer and hand folded in my home. So there's something about sharing the ideas that I had, and I didn't know how many ideas I had until I actually started writing them down.
Yeah, you're up to what, six?
Yes, yeah, sixth. And then there is a seventh that I made with my friend Spencer Hartling to accompany a cassette release that we did for a label here in LA called Leaving Records. So that's an album of guitar and tape loops called Show Invisibles. And essentially this album is, I mean, it's what we call dumb Frippinino. I play guitar and he manipulates it. We run it into a tape loop system. And the zine that comes with it, it's like it's a practical zine that teaches the reader how to use a tape machine essentially as a musical instrument. And of course, there are the sort of philosophical and psychological dimensions to it because I just can't help myself with that.
Okay. And for folks who can't visualize these, I mean, these are zines in like the classic sense, folded 8.5 by 11, black and white. You know, we used to have Kinko's. Now you're printing at home. That's a luxury we didn't have back in the day. But these books are just filled with little insights, kernels of wisdom, nuggets,
somewhere between like fortune cookie messages for guitarists and Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies or something. Like, you can just kind of flip to any page and there's something to think about or ponder, right?
Yeah. You know, what people have told me is that it's maybe particularly applicable to guitar players, but all kinds of creative people have read them and gotten back to me and given me feedback that it's more about creativity itself in its essence. And my philosophy has to do with being self-taught. For a long time, growing up in the era of shred guitar players, I felt kind of less than. And then slowly over the years, I realized that actually, if you spend enough time learning on your own, sort of tinkering with things, then you end up being sophisticated in this really unique way that can't be taught. So ultimately, I describe the aim of this writing project. It's to have a fun and productive relationship with the unknown.
Yeah. Self-taught, like I've been listening to your music since I found you through the zines and on Bandcamp, and I find that interesting because you're playing at a very high level, and there's, you know, I guess paths of ignition. I hear kind of Peter Lang, Robbie Basho, kind of Tacoma Records stuff going on, and then you get a little wilder with some synths and electronics and stuff. But like, what was the entry point into guitar for you? Like, when did you take it up and what were you trying to play?
So there's a line from one of the zines which goes, "Your obsessive nature is the only credible teacher." And this is me talking about myself. So from 11 years old onward, I spent most of my time with a guitar in some way. You know, usually it was my cheap Strat, Harmony Strat copy on a strap. And I wore it, you know, at all times. I would sit down to dinner with it. My mom tells me that the door jams in our house were all dinged up from me passing through them and banging either the headstock or the body as I passed through. But before that, I started singing in the church choir when I was 6. I was going to Episcopalian church with my grandmother. And she also gave me piano lessons, but it was with the Suzuki method. And I really valued that because it was all about learning by ear. And I realized that ultimately, she was setting me up to trust my ears. And I think at this point, if I have any one real gift, it's that I have a strong ear. I'm good at picking up songs and learning to play them quickly without tabs. And I did take some lessons from a guy named Charlie DeWeese in Monterey. And, you know, I have, at this point, real compassion for him looking back on those lessons, because I was asking him to teach me and help me figure out these songs by the Mummies or the Misfits or stuff that ultimately was so beneath his pay grade. You know, he was this really elegant Lenny Bro style jazz guitar player. And here I was asking him to teach me this stuff that was, you know, all downstrokes, you know, just the simplest stuff. And but he was really obliging, and that was cool. You know, he didn't make me feel less than for that. So I took some lessons, started exploring music, and I found myself really drawn to any moment in music where the instrumental stuff would get expanded. So, you know, things like the guitar solo on Suzy Q by Creedence Clearwater. Dick Dale was a big discovery for me. Side 2 of the first Black Sabbath record. And then I found John Fahey when I was about 13. And it was one of those moments that you can have with music where you hear a song and then all of a sudden your life is completely different. You know, in that moment you've reoriented to reality in a completely new way. So that taught me about open tunings, and I figured out some of the basic open tunings just by listening to the record and for the moments where he would hit sort of the big open major chord. I learned open G major that way, which is he learned that from Elizabeth Cotton, Fahey did, and open C major and D. And I started teaching myself John Fahey songs. And then years later, it was Peter Lang. Peter Lang became very important to me. And he really takes the complexity of finger picking to a new level. It took me a long time to figure out his stuff, but I figured out a bunch of his songs and started writing my own things that were related. But I think songs by him I figured out I figured out When Kings Come Home and a bunch of these other really beautiful, complex songs. And then I got to this point where I started feeling like, oh no, I'm on the way to becoming the next Alex Degrassi. And I mean, no disrespect to Degrassi, but that's really not what I wanted to be, because his music's really pretty, but it feels domesticated in a way that I didn't want to be. And there was something about John Fahey that felt rough, hewn, and wild, and woolly in a way that I really love. And I realized that in becoming a better guitar player, I was moving away from this kind of more primary expression that felt raw and immediate and real. And that ended up corresponding with a time when I got a shoulder injury. And because of that, playing the electric guitar, like a thinner profile Strat, started to feel a lot more comfortable. So I went into this long diversion of playing electric guitar for about 13 years. I sold my acoustic guitars, and I started playing in bands. I'd always played in bands, but at this point I was playing in bands that were, you know, touring and playing bigger shows. I played in Holy Shit, and I also played guitar for Sam Flax for 5 years. And that led me to making all these solo guitar records, which really had more krautrock, minimalist, and arty punk influences.
Yeah. What's the story? One of the records that stood out to me was Wild Boy. What was the story with that one?
Wild Boy, yeah. I call that my cursed record.
It's a great record.
Well, I recorded it with Sam Flax at his house in Berkeley, and he really makes such beautiful recordings, so I love the sound of that record. But it ended up getting tied up in record label red tape for like 5 years, and then I got dropped off the label. So it took me a long time to get it together for a self-release, and I finally did that. But it never did as well as my other records. But like Paths of Ignition, I was trying to fuse these different things, like my interest in guitar players like Sonny Chirac or someone like Ornette Coleman, with the John Fahey, Peter Lang thing. So it was my attempt to resolve these things that were not exactly opposite, but which I saw as very different. You know, I always worked in record stores and was thinking about combining all these different influences. So I'm very fond of that record, but I don't think it did as well as I wished it would have. So maybe someday it'll be resurrected.
You got to burn the sage around it, or the masters. Yeah.
I think so. Cleanse it somehow.
What, when you're playing these kind of Peter Lang-y, you know, more Raga-esque, longer form acoustic numbers, what guitar do you lean on? What are you using?
Right now I'm back on the acoustic after doing some rehab on my shoulder, lifting weights, and it's become comfortable to play acoustic again. I've also learned about posture. I've always had terrible posture as a guitar player. One drawback from being self-taught is that maybe if I had studied more, I would have learned that if you sit up straight and hold your guitar in the right way, that you're not going to mess up your shoulder. So I'm back on the acoustic, writing these long things. I call them Gaelic ragas, or Gaelic fourth worlds, to borrow a term from John Hassell. I'm playing a Martin right now, and I'm ashamed to admit, I don't know if it's a double or a triple O. It's the simple Depression-style mahogany guitar with no binding and a very simple rosette around the sound hole, but it's a great guitar.
Yeah. And you're in L.A. now?
Yeah, I'm in South Pasadena.
Okay. So I find you through these zines, then I go down the rabbit hole of finding your Bandcamp and really enjoying the music. That was kind of when I reached out to you. And then I find on your Instagram bio that you work, and I'll screw this up, so apologies, but music-centered psychedelic integration?
That's right.
Talk to me about this. Tell folks about this. This might be the more controversial part of the podcast because we're talking about some substances and stuff, but I want to hear all about it. I'm super fascinated, and I've talked to a couple of other like-minded guitarists, and we're all kind of like, we got to ask them about that. So here we are.
Well, it shouldn't be that controversial, hopefully, because everything I'm doing is legal and carried out with a real excess of clinical care and forethought. So I went to graduate school and became a psychotherapist, and I've worked in the field for about 10 years now. I've done a bunch of different things in community mental health. I've worked in psychiatric hospitals, worked for different agencies. And in the last 4 years, I've worked in private practice and starting to do more and more psychedelic work. I went through one of the first psychedelic psychotherapy training programs in anticipation of the legalization of psilocybin and MDMA. And while I was waiting around for this to happen, I realized that people are already doing legal psychedelic work with ketamine, which is, it's an anesthetic, but within a certain dosage range becomes a psychedelic. And you can have these incredible experiences that are really good for things like depression, anxiety, PTSD, addictions, you know, the things that plague all of us. And so I started working with my colleague, Dr. Mark Short, doing ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. And we recently opened a remote or online ketamine clinic called the Ketamine Providers Network. And that provides more conventional ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. And then we started to notice something in our work. In the psychedelic training that we'd received, we were encouraged to think about music as something that was, you know, really important to the process of psychedelic healing. But there wasn't a sense of finality or clarity on exactly how to use the music. And we noticed that if we really dialed the music in and administered that aspect of the session well, then the outcomes in terms of the symptoms that people were coming in to address were way better. And we're not the first people to observe this, right? This moves us towards the concepts behind music-centered psychedelic integration. And really what that is it's our own proprietary therapy that we've developed. In standard psychedelic psychotherapy, you'll do preparation work, which is typically some kind of verbal processing, providing background information and talking about what you want to achieve in the course of treatment, your goals, intentions, stuff like that. Then you have the trip, which is supported by music, typically with an eye shade on and headphones. And then you have the integration sessions, which involve, you know, work done in order to stay connected to the insights of the psychedelic experience. So that's often more verbal processing, maybe some somatic stuff. And we noticed that music is actually useful to help support and integrate really at every phase of psychedelic treatment. So we're using music to help people prepare and to integrate in addition to its role during the trip itself. And then we've developed a number of what we call integrative listening practices, which are these ways to engage more deeply with the music. And I think the model that standard psychedelic psychotherapy uses is one where the psychedelic is the medicine and that the music helps to push that process along. We really turn that understanding on its head, or at least we kind of equalize things to the extent that we're saying that music is the medicine and that the psychedelic helps to open you up to that. So maybe it's more fair to say that they're kind of equal process, equal partners, and that they potentiate each other. So perhaps at least initially, MCPI attracts people who are already really preoccupied with music. But we're finding that everyone who experiences music-centered psychedelic integration, or MCPI as we call it, responds to it very well. So we're starting groups in LA and setting up a weekend workshop in New York, and we're also taking private clients. So it's a more music-heavy form of psychedelic psychotherapy. And in addition to the music-centered psychedelic integration protocol, we really hope to bring extremely high standards to the curation of psychedelic musical experiences and to the sound quality involved in facilitating them.
I'm fascinated. I have so many questions for you. You're an average person. I know probably because of HIPAA stuff, you can't talk about specific people and their transformations necessarily, but like, I'm coming into you, I'm signing up, I have anxiety or PTSD. Are we talking about live music, like you're playing guitar? Are we talking about pre-recorded music? Like what happens, like literally?
Well, we're working towards it being both. Because one of the main mechanisms we're working with here, therapeutic mechanisms, is that, and this is something that people with psychedelic experiences know, right? Which is that if you listen to a piece of music in a deep psychedelic state and you go back and listen to that song later, you're like, whoa, that song is charged up. And the next time you listen to it, the hair on the back of your neck starts to stand up and you're able to, through the music, re-inhabit that deep psychedelic state and connect to all of the personal insights and wisdom that came along with it. So that's one of the integrative listening practices that we're talking about, which is to listen back to music that you've listened to in a previous psychedelic experience. And in order for that to work, that would have to be the exact same music. So in that case, it would necessarily be pre-recorded music. We are talking about doing it with live performance too, but that might not be a music-centered psychedelic integration thing. It might be more of a standard type of psychedelic psychotherapy because of the difficulties involved in perfectly recreating a live performance. So working with ketamine is interesting because one of the things that psychedelic clinicians notice is that certain psychedelic medicines tune themselves to specific types of music. There might be certain moments in a ketamine session where acoustic guitar music like the kind I'm making right now might be really good. But then again, I've also noticed that ketamine really seems to play well with electronic music. I suspect that might have something to do with ketamine making people hypersensitive to little variations in timing and that are smoothed out in more metronomic types of electronic music. Now, having said that, I'm not a big electronic music person. I mean, I like Steve Roach. I think that Structures from Silence, for instance, is one of the best pieces of ketamine music ever. I think there's some great stuff by Carl Stone, Pauline Oliveros. I also like using Manuel Gottsching from Ashraw. So working clinically with ketamine has pushed me into really needing to explore more music, specifically electronic music. And I'm not sure if playing acoustic guitar would be the best thing for it. I think that might be better for psilocybin or a different medicine.
Do the participants, I mean, music is such a subjective thing and we've all been in, you know, we've all been at a place where music is played that makes us cringe or we're like, I got to get out of here. I hate what this restaurant's doing. Do the participants get to choose at all and say like, you know what, don't give me anything new agey. I hate that stuff. Or
so we do what we call a musical intake. You know, you do your psychological and medical intakes, but then the musical intake is like, it's really a jumping off point for a big discussion about music. What you want to do with psychedelic work, at least the musical part of it, is you don't want to play stuff for people that they already know, because new music, when you're encountering it under the medicine, you experience that as exploring new parts of yourself. So you don't want to listen to the same thing you've listened to a million times. Like Harold Budd's Pavilion of Dreams. I've listened to that a million times and I have very specific associations with it. So you want to find new music. And at the same time, you don't want to play music that's aversive to someone that they're not going to enjoy, right? You don't want them to be cringing through the whole thing. That would be what I call, as a therapist, a kind of misattunement where you're not tuning into the client and what they need in that moment. So Dr. Short and I have a saying, which is that personal musical knowledge is a clinical skill. So what you know about music as a psychedelic therapist is really important. There's a certain level of training and experience with music that I think psychedelic clinicians need to get. And this is where I think my years of having worked in record stores are perhaps the most important part of my education. So to answer your question, you're not playing them what they want to hear. They're not putting in requests for songs, but you're also playing them things that are within the ballpark of their taste and that aren't going to bum them out.
I am so fascinated by this. And the piece of music that is played both during the trip or whatever we want to call it, and then referred back to in the follow-up, is that a generally a longer piece of music? Are we talking about an album with actual tracks, or like what's the ideal? In your, like, how does that work?
You know, I think this is where you get into the art of selecting music for these experiences. And I know that there's a bunch of different ideas about this. I know people who've worked in the underground through the 80s and 90s, the Prohibition times, when this work was totally illegal. And they had a real culture of sharing music. So they'd be like, Terry Riley is particularly good for this moment. And, you know, there are different phases to a psychedelic trip. So for this phase, we found that this other music is really good. And there was a culture of music sharing and knowing about music. And that's something that I'm really interested in. As a former record store employee, as a person that's always gone to shows, starting with punk shows when I was 12, what I'm interested in is musical culture. And I think that musical culture is the soil that this kind of awareness grows out of, you know, having lots of options to offer someone who's going to have one of these experiences. But I think I talked my way away from your question though.
No, I was just curious if it's like an entire album or suite of songs, or is it just one like 8-minute track that then, you know, the participant refers back to and plays at home later. And, you know, I just didn't know.
Yeah, I think that's up to the discretion of the person who's making the playlist. So we're definitely open to feedback in the moment. If something about the music isn't working for someone, you know, they can make a change in the course of the musical flow. Playlists are often made out of different tracks from different albums, but sometimes I do like to play a whole album or a chunk of an entire album for someone, because really the artist has already spent so much time thinking about the flow between songs, and sometimes the songs will have a similar texture, like a nice continuous thing. Mm-hmm. So a ketamine experience is typically about an hour and a half long. So it's not a ton of music, you know? I've made playlists for, I made one for a university study with psilocybin, for instance, and that involves coming up with 6 or 7 hours of music, and that's a lot harder to do. So ketamine is a shorter, much shorter duration and easier to choose music for. You could play an album and a half, and if you want to make something that involves a bunch of different tracks from different artists, it's not hard to do.
I have so many more questions. Sorry. This is so fascinating to me. I hope I'm not boring the listeners to tears. But, you know, I think a lot of folks have dabbled in marijuana, which is legal in many places. Fewer have gone probably mushrooms and LSD and things like that. Explain to me what, you know, and then there's like ayahuasca and things that are even more exotic. How does the ketamine, the influence of ketamine, the trip, how does it differ? It's shorter, you just said, than like mushrooms. But what is it? Is it very similar? Do you also, can it go bad? Can you have a bad ketamine trip?
Yes. Yeah. I think that part of psychedelic training is to learn that difficult is not necessarily bad. You know, oftentimes the difficult ones, if you work with them, integrate them, they can be really valuable. So I'm pretty open that I've had psychedelic experiences since I was a teenager. And more recently, I've had ketamine experiences as a part of trainings and had it prescribed. And so I try to be honest that this is something that I've done too. And I think it would be a little disingenuous if I didn't do that. I've definitely had difficult experiences, but I think that the difficult experiences oftentimes involve the emergence of something. You know, if you want to go Jungian, you could call it shadow stuff, something within you that wants to be addressed, processed, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's an opportunity to shine the light of awareness on aspects of ourselves that are largely unconscious, causing you trouble, and to come to terms with them and then decide what you want to do about it in terms of how you live your life day to day. So I think that any psychedelic experience can be difficult, but that they can also be blissful and rapturous, right? I think ketamine itself has its own unique character because it's an anesthetic. Like if you break your leg skiing, they're going to give you probably a big injection of ketamine before they put you into the helicopter to get you to the hospital. But that's at a much higher dose than you use in psychedelic therapy with ketamine. So at the lower psychotherapeutic doses, it still has an anesthetic thing. So it creates a kind of bubble, this kind of soft, cushioned bubble that your consciousness is within terms of how you experience it. And then within that bubble, the psychedelic insights unfold. So it has a very specific feel. It's not like other psychedelic medicines. With psilocybin and LSD, it can often feel like the security blanket is being ripped away from you and you're kind of dangling over an abyss, you know, and you sometimes just have to hold on through those kinds of experiences. But ketamine is generally softer and more friendly, and it's a better work day for everyone because you're not engaged for 6 to 12 hours. It's more like an hour or two.
It's consumed orally? Or how?
Oral and intramuscular injection.
Okay. And what, you know, this is an ad for you guys, but like what you're doing that I think is fascinating is that, you know, sometimes you hear about these experiences and it's sort of like, you know, not moderated, not a professional, it's some friend of a friend. To know that there are actual medical practitioners and that you're in a safe spot is really important for a million reasons. And so that is super intriguing. Is ketamine the end all, or is it just the one legal substance that is being used as a tool now, whereas psilocybin is still, aside from maybe Oregon, verboten?
I thought of ketamine more when I first encountered it as a kind of opportunity to do psychedelic psychotherapy under the prohibition of really almost all other psychedelic molecules. As I've come to work with it, I've realized that it's an incredibly powerful medicine, and I've seen it help a lot of people in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that necessarily means that it's the end-all, be-all, but I've come to respect it as an incredibly powerful medicine for people with a variety of mental health struggles.
And this is something, again, I'm super ignorant. This is something synthetically made, so the dosage and everything is the same every time, whereas mushrooms or even pot could be wildly different.
Yes, right. I think that's where they're headed with psilocybin therapy, which will likely be legal in the next couple of years, is that you'll be taking a synthetically generated version of pure psilocybin and psilocin so they can really dose it out. So you probably won't be consuming actual mushrooms when psilocybin therapy is legal.
Yeah. And what does your client base look like? I can imagine there being two schools of people, and we're all human. We all have our flaws. We all have our demons. But I can see people who have like real anxiety, PTSD, potentially could harm themselves or whatever. And then I could also see just the creative class wanting to unlock, you know, the next record, the next book, the next whatever. How is your clientele? Like, what does it look like?
Well, because it's a psychotherapeutic medical intervention for the time being, our work requires a specific set of symptoms and a diagnosis in order to meet what we call medical necessity. But then again, I think that's a good goal for psychedelic psychotherapy and drug policy to shoot towards, which is what we call the betterment of already well people. And that could involve self-exploration, self-knowledge, enhancement of creativity, spiritual experiences. I mean, these are all things that psychedelics offer. And that's what's so interesting about psychedelic medicine is that it's not just like you've got a headache, so you take an aspirin. It's not this kind of one-for-one thing. It's really this large sort of fractal event where everything connects to everything else, and it has to do with meaning and connectivity within your brain. And oftentimes you experience that as connectivity between yourself and the rest of the universe. And so it's a whole different type of medicine. And Western medicine is very interested in this. They're very interested. And I think that spiritually speaking, they don't really know what they're doing. I think that there's some kind of toothpaste that's being squeezed out of the tube here that's not going to go back in when people have these experiences. I mean, that's the whole point of doing this, is that it changes you. And that's also why I'm really interested in responsible psychedelic use, is that these things are also not harmless. They have been used to harm people, or if they're used irresponsibly, they can cause people problems. So I think it's important to have a good culture around it. Having a good medical protocol is also important. And I'm not just an advocate of strict medicalization. I think that you see this in the culture of underground psychedelic psychotherapy, underground psychedelic cultures. They had a set of sort of inherited wisdom about how to be safe with this. We see this in the Grateful Dead community, the rave community. These are all people who, in many cases, had a greater shared cultural wisdom for how to stay safe with these things.
Sure. As a professional who's probably either as an A/B test or just because of how you do your business, like done this with the music component and without the music component, what does the music bring to the table? What effects has it had on people that maybe they wouldn't have had if music wasn't playing, if there wasn't this playlist?
So just to be clear, there is no modern psychedelic psychotherapy protocol that doesn't involve music.
Oh, okay.
Except for they used to talk about this thing called psycholytic therapy that involves taking a very low dose and doing talk therapy. But psychedelic psychotherapy, oftentimes people find out that that's what I do and they're like, microdosing. And I say, no, actually we're talking about macrodosing, you know, large doses that have transformative effects. So I think that this is something that people just knew intuitively. You know, you see it throughout indigenous traditions that use psychedelic medicines. I mean, there are certain peyote traditions that involve being in silence in the desert, but almost always there's song or drumming or some kind of collective music thing. And so this is where some neuroscience can become really interesting, because there's a researcher, Mendel Kaelin, and I hope I'm getting this right, but the way that I'm understanding his research, he was doing a doctoral dissertation at Imperial College, was that when you take something like LSD, there are these visual centers in the brain that are lit up. And when you listen to music, there's another part of another brain structure that has to do with memory that gets lit up. Now, if you combine LSD and music, those two parts of the brain start communicating with each other in unprecedented ways. Now, I don't want to just reduce this stuff down to, it's just visual and memory centers in the brain communicating. But I think more importantly, it indicates how psychedelics combined with music cause extraordinary connectivity between brain regions that are normally isolated from one another. And the way that I understand that that is that it kicks off like a neuroplastic process where you might find that you have a very specific neural channel that's firing in a way that corresponds to depressed thinking or anxious thinking or a PTSD response. And that cascade of connectivity is sending out all these new creeper vines around it. And which in the days and weeks following a psychedelic experience, you can really experience as being able to think new thoughts, different types of thoughts, and to have new behaviors. And I've seen that happen, and it is so inspiring as a therapist that someone who's been struggling with something in therapy for years, and then they have this experience that pushes them through this threshold, and all of a sudden they begin living in a different way. And I've seen that happen, and I'm getting chills thinking about it, talking about it, because it's very real.
I mean, as a musician, all anyone ever tries to do is connect and resonate with the end user. And I know this isn't your music being played during these experiences, but as a musician, it must be really profound to just see the impact.
Yeah, there's a song, right? And the song title floats through my head sometimes. Last night, a DJ saved my life. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like that. These are very high stakes musical encounters that do end up changing people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's a huge honor to be a musician whose music gets used in these sessions, because the person is having the most high def technicolor experience of merging with your music and then having it fundamentally change them. And I think that one thing that Dr. Short and I want to do with music-centered psychedelic integration is to bring a culture of real musical taste and knowledge to psychedelic work. Because I think sometimes you're right, the music feels wimpy, whack new age music, or you're listening to some kind of techno or other music that's maybe not resonating with you. And those are just the types of music that I'm averse to, you know, not trying to hear during a psychedelic experience. And it's different for everyone. So I'm trying to learn a lot about different types of music so that I can serve people with diverse tastes. Our goal is to really bring a culture of very well curated music to psychedelic work. Like if someone needs to move within genres, we want to be able to be the best. We want it to be the best of those genres, and we want it all to flow in a way that really supports a kind of inner journey that ultimately is an experience that's just beyond language and really reorients someone to reality.
Yeah, well, and I guess also as an educator and professional, you're going to need to guide people, because not everybody who needs this help the most is going to be a record nerd and know that Harold Budd is versus Brian Eno or whatever you're trying to throw at them.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And this is a big debate in the psychedelic psychotherapy community. Some people are under the medicine and they will take the eye shade off and say, I need you to push me harder. And then I'm like, okay, we're going maybe Electric Miles. Maybe we need to get into some really intense John McLaughlin, Pete Cozy guitar solos, or maybe Sonny Chirac. And then there's other people who will say to me, you know, I really don't want to feel manipulated by the music. I want to feel like the music is more this kind of gentle, ethereal thing that I can float on top of. So I think that that's where people tend to have their own experiences and then project that onto everyone else. Whereas I find myself wanting to be flexible so that if someone is more of the non-manipulative school, then I can provide that for them. Or if someone wants to be more energized by the experience, I can do that well too.
And you said you've got workshops in LA and then in New York and probably some other places. How are folks being, and you also said ketamine is prescribed. So it's like, how are folks finding you? What type of people, do people get referred to you? Like, how does this... What's the funnel to get to one of these workshops?
Yeah, well, that's what we're figuring out right now. We're just beginning to promote this thing that we launched. One of the main things is that I know a bunch of therapists, and I'm part of an alumni association for some of the programs that I've been through. So we're beginning to spread word there. But then again, it's not just open to clinicians. They're going to be open to the public. And then I have a base of clients who I've worked with over the years and referrals from other clinicians we know too.
So anyone could participate, or do you sometimes talk to people and you're like, you're in this for the wrong reasons, this is not a good fit?
Right. Anyone could participate, but they're going to need a qualifying diagnosis. But then again, many, many people have anxiety. Many people have some kind of depression. Yeah. But to be clear, there are medical and psychological contraindications for ketamine. You know, it's not for everyone, and that's why we screen very carefully.
I can obviously sense your enthusiasm about this program and the potential it has. Are there any cases where, if you were being brutally honest, it just doesn't work well?
I think there are definitely people who should not take psychedelics, at least not under the current paradigm. I think about an indigenous group called the Huni Queen, and if I remember correctly, I think it's that everyone in the entire community drinks ayahuasca twice a week, year in, year out. So this involves, you know, kids, old people, pregnant women, you know, like everyone. So they've created a cultural container where that's okay and where that works for them. You know, I can't imagine having a soul-devouring experience like that twice a week, but I also live under the specific pressures of our society. So I guess I'm trying to frame this up as culturally contextual. And I think that in our culture, mm-hmm. with the current context, there are probably certain people who should avoid psychedelic work because they might become unstable. Like psychosis, for instance. If someone is chronically psychotic or prone to psychotic symptoms when they're under stress, like we don't as a culture do a very good job of supporting that experience. With people like that, we tend to medicate them heavily or confine them. And I think that those interventions, while sometimes necessary to protect that person or the people around them, are ultimately harmful and ensure that the experience of psychosis is reinforced in a particularly damaging and terrifying way.
Yeah.
So I'm very careful if someone has that in their background or if I sense that it could be a dynamic in play. And I've also worked with some people who abuse psychedelics, who take them too often, too much, don't do adequate work to prepare or to integrate. I think of psychedelics as these powerful engines or openers that can be used to really open people up to do incredible work. But you can also, on a psychological level, open yourself up in the same way that a surgeon opens you up. And if you don't know what you're doing, then it's potentially dangerous. So again, I think that there are certain people who should not use psychedelics or at the very least, they should do extensive preparation to see if they even are ready at some point in the future.
Yeah. To bring this back a little bit to music and music making and guitars, has your role doing this, the experiences you've had as a practitioner, has that changed how you approach your own music and the role it plays and maybe as a form of healing or maybe just as a form of relaxation or, you know, just anything like from where you were 10 years ago?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things. And this gets back to how I wrote the zines, which is that those are super refined versions of thoughts that I've had since I was a little kid. There were certain things that I just knew about creativity. And in mm-hmm. applying those again and again and again, they've turned into this kind of deeply practical wisdom. So the work that I've done, it builds on things that I've always intuitively knew were true. But then it's also changed how I listen to music. You know, John Hassell called it playing Hunger Games with music. And this is something like musical fasting, where I don't listen to music so that it kind of sharpens my appetite. And when I come back to it, I really devour it and I'm really excited about it. So I've been doing that and also having certain types of music set aside for psychedelic work. Like, for instance, I'm not going to listen to Shriek Hamel by Terry Riley driving in my car. I'll listen to James Brown. I'll listen to Iggy Pop, but there are certain things that I feel like are set aside for psychedelic work at this point. Also, it's gotten me really into sound quality. I grew up in the 90s, and lo-fi sound quality had a much more pleasing sound to it back then because it was on cassette and it sounded velvety and beautifully compressed and muffled in this mysterious way. I mean, bad sound quality now, like bad digital sound quality, is really bad. Like digital distortion is not pleasant. So in the realm of digital, I've gotten really interested in having things be really nice. And that's been a big shift in my thinking.
Okay. So ketamine therapy may turn you into an audiophile is what you're saying.
Yes, that's right. In psychedelic work, we talk about set and setting, right? And I think that sound quality is an important part of the setting. And that, sure, you could give someone a good experience with a 128 kilobyte per second MP3, but they're going to notice if it's master quality and being played through a nice system. And that's one thing we're investing in, is really extraordinarily nice stereo equipment.
Incredible. Do you have any new recordings on the horizon?
I do. I've been obsessed with this idea for maybe 15 years that came from a little interview that I read with Davy Graham, the guitarist Davy Graham, where he was talking about the Indo-European root connection between Celtic languages and those from the Indian subcontinent. This idea that traditional Celtic music was somehow related to something like early versions of Indian classical music. So he wrote this incredible thing, and he only recorded short little versions of it called either, I think it was Blue Raga or She Moved Through the Bazaar. And it's him playing this kind of flowing Celtic music, but in a way that is similar to Raga music. Similar, like in its kind of droning style, and I thought it should be similar in its length. But he never did that, or at least not that I've heard. So I've been working on these very big, long pieces of instrumental guitar music that are flowing Gaelic or Celtic raga music, and I'm calling it Gaelic Fourth World, which is a nod to the trumpet player John Hassell, who had these ideas that were similar to fusion, but not in the sense of like layer cake fusion, layer cake, deep forest fusion, where you're just putting the synthesizer on top of the tribal drumming. It's more the idea that these cultural entities are actually exchanging DNA and producing offspring that are genuine, new, weird, beautiful things. So that's the record. It's called Gaelic Fourth World, and I'm in the process of shopping it around to record labels right now.
So cool. We've covered a lot of ground. I have a feeling there'll be some questions from folks listening to this, and people will want to hear more. How can people learn more about your music, the zines, the work you're doing? Like, what's the easiest way?
Instagram is kind of like my resume. It's all about my writing, music, and psychedelic work. Our ketamine clinic, the Ketamine Providers Network, is you can find that at ketamineprovidersnetwork.com. And for those who want to find out more about music-centered psychedelic integration or cutting-edge therapy, that's at music-centered.org. And then I have a Bandcamp, which carries LPs, cassettes, and the full series of How to Play Guitar zines. That is psychicarts.bandcamp.com.
Yeah, you can listen to the cursed record. That actually doesn't sound cursed to me. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, right on.
Well, Matt, thank you so much. This was super insightful. I know we just scratched the surface on all that you are up to, but I wanted to ask you about that because I listened to the music, I read the zines, and then I saw this other thing. I was like, oh, I'm equally fascinated by that, your day job. So,
yeah. Well, Jason, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, that was my conversation with Matt Baldwin. I learned a lot. I hope you did as well. I'm sure Matt will field any and all questions that you send his way if anyone out there is interested. All of us Fretboard Journal people tend to hang out and support each other. And I hope everybody out there is doing well. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Till next time.